Hello, this is a second conversation between myself, Dr. Stephanie Delussey, a teaching professor and honors faculty fellow, and Dr. Mark Jacobs, the second dean of Barrett, the Honors College at Arizona State University. Dr. Jacobs has kindly agreed to be recorded as he shares more of his memories and insights from his development and leadership of the college for the 19 years that he was dean. This gives him a rich and meaningful perspective. Our first recorded conversation offered his educational background and some highlights of his professional path, his arrival at ASU, and how well he worked together with Vice Dean Peggy Nelson and his Associate Dean Kristen Herman. So today, Mark, I thought perhaps we'd talk about what your relationship was with the Barretts and perhaps. Because people listening to this might not know anything about the Barretts. Maybe you could tell us about the Barretts and how you met them and that relationship was or developed over time.
Sure. Well, Craig and Barbara Barrett are the patrons of the Honors College. Craig was the CEO of Intel, of the whole of Intel worldwide, when I came out in 2003. And Barbara Barrett had been all sorts of things. She had run for governor of the state. She was the manager of their resort in Montana, the Triple Creek Ranch. And she was going to be, during the 19 years that I knew her and Craig, both the ambassador to Finland, the US ambassador to Finland, and the secretary of the Air Force, which became the Space Force while she was the secretary of the Air Force. So I think they're now listed as separate entities, but they have one secretary. So Barbara was very well known in the state. She had worked at a law firm, Phoenix, right after law school. She was very closely connected to Senator Day O'Connor. And so she had lots of connections within the state. Craig had lots of connections worldwide because of his sort of leadership experiences in the field of microchip processing and fabrication and stuff like that. So they were a well-known couple already. The fact that they were interested in Barrett was lent Barrett a great amount of credence in the valley and the state and in the nation, I think. So it was a very valuable relationship, and it was easy to keep up because they were such nice people. Now, would you like to know about what they were doing as I came out in 2003, or?
Yeah, whatever you'd care to share about that, like when you first met them, or if you co-created something together, or maybe you didn't interact with them all that much, or maybe it varied over the years.
Well, we interacted at least 3 or 4 times a year anyway, because they came to one of them at least came to almost every Barrett graduation or convocation. So they came in the fall and the spring usually, and they were very dedicated patrons, I think, in the sense that they took a major role in the graduations. They shook every student's hand as they came across the stage and greeted them. Barbara, with her ambassador experience, was a terrific diplomat anyway. She was amazing in how she could get personal stories out of each student, even within 3 seconds or 5 seconds or maybe 8 seconds that she was given as they came across the stage. But many times Craig was there at her side, and they both shook the students' hands as they graduated. So they were very dedicated. They came to graduations. They came to some of the events. They were very busy people, though. They were world travelers every year. In fact, even this year, I just got a Christmas sort of period, multi photo and description letter from them, which I got every year from them when I was dean. It showed where they'd been. They're just amazing world travelers, even in retirement for Craig. I hesitate to say that either of them is really fully retired, but Craig is no longer the CEO of Intel, and Barbara, I think that she still manages the ranch up in Montana. But aside from that, they'd still love to travel and see all these connections that they have all over the world that each of them has built over their careers. I think they met when Barbara at least was in her 40s, I think, or early 40s, maybe. Let's see. I think that was about right. the story is they met at the top of Camelback Mountain when they both hiked up to see the sunset. It was a very romantic story. They met at the top there. They were the two people up there as the sunset one day. It's really a nice story. I don't know if it's really true, but it sounds great. I think it is true.
Yeah.
I think it was true from what Barbara told me.
Oh, yes. And they're such people of integrity. I can't imagine them making up how they met.
I can't imagine that either. So they met later in life. Craig had been married before and had kids. I don't think Barbara had. I don't think she was married before and didn't have children. But their life started together around that time, probably 1990s, in the 1990s, maybe. And then they had decided, with Lottie Kaur's very important friendship and input, to give a gift to the Honors College. Really, Lottie doesn't get enough credit for that, but they gave a $10 million gift, which was a naming gift. They did not ask for it to be naming. They've said many times they didn't want to be it be named after them, and they didn't ask for that, but it was nonetheless, because it was such a huge gift at the time. At the time, it was the biggest gift, single gift that had ever been given to ASU.
Right. I'm
Yes.
so glad they allowed it to be named after them because it's a positive example for other people of such means in the world. And it did allow for that more personal relationship to be built, just as you described, Barbara taking that extra effort with each student as they crossed the stage, even.
Oh yeah, it was very, I mean, and because Craig was so well known already as a captain of industry, and Barbara was extremely well known around the state because she was politically connected, since she had run for governor, although she didn't win that contest. She had run for governor, and to do that, she had made all sorts of connections around the state. So they were both, the fact that they favored Barrett Honors College by giving this gift that became a naming gift. They did not ask for that. They said many times that they're sort of embarrassed that Lottie and others decided to make it a naming gift, but still they wanted to support it after Lottie had described what it was about. But Lottie was the one who sort of convinced them that this would make a huge difference for the Honors College at ASU, and they were happy to jump in. At the time, around the same time, they were starting to support the some other educational levels. So, for instance, what is the
Basis.
yes, the basic schools, right? That was starting down in Tucson at the time, and they supported that. And Craig was on the board of that. Craig started basic schools in lots of different places in Arizona, and then later in other states even. And then they finally, during the time that I was dean, and that I was already here, they supported Thunderbird Graduate College just before it became merged with ASU as the School of International Business, I guess. Is that what you would call it now? Now it's sort of the Thunderbird School of International Management or something like that.
Oh,
But,
yeah, it has a more broad name. I can look it up for you at some point. But
yeah, but
at the moment, I'm remembering that didn't the Barretts gift the college with an additional amount of money in regard to global leadership?
yes, that happened much later, but yes, that was true. So the $10 million was the largest gift that had ever been given to ASU. But shortly after I, and it was given in 1999 and 2000. So there's a picture of Barbara and Craig with Ted Humphrey, the dean at the time, with a big check for $10 million, and they're holding one of those big cardboard checks they used to show when people gave a significant gift. And that was when they gave the gift. So it was already the Barrett Honors College when I came in 2003. And they were just, I met them right away within the first couple of weeks. They had Ellen and me over for a meal, and then they had us up to their ranch in Montana, which was really a wonderful vacation, but also a really nice chance to see them both when they were relaxed. And Maddie was, our daughter Madeline was three, I think, three or so at the time, 3 or 4. And Craig and she bonded very much, very quickly, fishing in a special fish pond that had lots of fish stocked in it up there and such. And she made him some ceramic pencil holders and things like that that she later gave, and he still has on his desk. So I mean, Craig is a wonderful guy. He has his own grandchildren, but he and Maddie bonded. Maddie and Barbara, there's a picture we have of Barbara and Maddie on a horse that was called Pentium Prince. Maddie called it the horse Princeton because the only prince she knew was Princeton, because that's where I grew up and my parents were, and she had gone to see her grandparents there already. But Barbara took Maddie with her on a horseback ride we took through the forest up on their ranch right away in the fall. So it was just a wonderful on-ramp to the relationship, and the relationship was always so good, so great. Never any looking over my shoulder at what I was doing, just fully trusting me, the same as Michael Crow had always done. They weren't demanding in any way. They never made any request or demand because of their station as patrons ever. And yet they came whenever they were around. They came to things like celebrating honors symposium at the end of the year, and the two convocations, and some of the lectures. Excuse me. Just to fully support the students, and every time they showed up, they delighted in the students. You could tell they were delighting in the students and taking lots of time with them to talk to them. So it was
That
really,
sounds wonderful.
yeah.
Yeah, and for a while, as you were talking about, Barbara was the interim president of the Thunderbird School of Global Management,
Yes.
which I think now is a unit of the University Knowledge Enterprise. But as I said, I'll look into that a little bit more. But
No, it's
I
one of the
heard.
schools of ASU because it has its own dean.
Yeah.
It's there, so I don't think it's just under the Enterprise label.
So, can you tell me more about the later relationship and that next connection with the global leadership that they helped create?
Yes, well, we. Sorry, I'm just going to have a little drink of water here. We kept the relationship with them going, of course, and it was easy to do. They kept it up too. And something like, must have been late 19, it must have been the late 2020s, late 2010s, sort of 2017, 2018. We were having we being Peggy Nelson and Kristen Herman and I were having our annual summer meeting where we just shot ideas back and forth with each other about what we wanted to do with Barrett and what Barrett should still try to be striving to become and stuff like that. Those were great meetings, by the way. Lasted half a day. We'd go for lunch and then have another half day. So sometimes maybe we had several day meetings in June and July just talking about the future of Barrett. But in one of those meetings, I was saying, I thought there should be more of an international experience for our students and presence of programs. And we kind of cooked up the whole idea of Barrett Global then. This is before we hired anybody to head it, of course. But we also knew that it might take some funding, and we knew that one way we could one part of the program could be supporting students with scholarships when they went abroad for various experiences, but the other part could be bringing world leaders in to ASU and Barrett as residents, scholars in residence sort of things, where they could teach a course and give a general plenary lecture to the whole university, but also have a short course if possible that they offered. So, sort of like the model that the Rhodes and Centennial lecturers had been in the past. Where they had in the first years of my administration, they had come for 3 or 4 days and given little mini courses, but that had devolved because particularly the Rhodes family wanted to have more big names, and to get a bigger name, we had to pay more, and to pay more, we could no longer support salaries over a week of studies and support for classes or classes that the visiting person for the Rhodes lectureship could offer. So those became more just single shot wonderful talks. But we wanted to set up a thing like the Rhodes and Centennial had originally been, where there was someone who was well known, who was an expert in their field, who came in and was in residence at Barrett. And By so doing, we could expose the students to new ideas, totally new ideas from different countries, different viewpoints, but always from leaders. And to do that, we knew we would need to use Barbara's connections, because she particularly had, after she had been the U.S. ambassador to Finland, actually even before that, but she was already well known with all the leaders around the world. She was part of this Global Leaders Foundation, I think it was called, but it was a organization that you had to have been a prime minister or president of a country to belong to. And it gave it, it could be called in as a consulting group to any president or prime minister of any country in the world that wanted to have advice. And she was connected to that in many ways. And so we had some talks with her and Craig, about whether she was willing to do that. She was extremely happy to do that. And in fact, she was always sort of leading us a little bit and saying, "Hey, I've got a great person that I think would be good to come for next year, for next semester, that sort of thing." And she brought in people like the first female defense minister for Finland, the president of Latvia, who was a woman who had been the president for 6 years or so, and then just had stepped down, I believe, at the time. Or maybe she hadn't, because she came with a lot of security with her, followed her around. But anyway, the point is, during that time, we also asked, we made an ask of the Barretts. Well, the whole university made an ask of the Barretts for a second $10 million. But part of that was $2.5 million or $3 million for Barrett itself to help fund these residencies and travels associated with them, and some of the scholarships for students to travel abroad. So that was, and that, so that, that, that became the second gift the Barretts gave to all of ASU, because half of it was given to the law school at the time, I think. Barbara has always been associated with the law school as well. Excuse me.
Well, I went to some of those talks and they were good, and a number of my students went, and it's such a unique opportunity. So I'm really glad that you hatched that idea with the team and that they supported it.
Yeah, well, we were very happy with the way it worked out. Then when we hired Jason, he's been terrific. And he is sort of, at the same time, Mark Henderson was retiring from being the dean of Barrett at Poly. And he had started this Global Resolve program of students going out to other countries and doing volunteer community support work in other countries, and he wanted very much to have that keep going. So as he was retiring, he asked if Barrett could take that program over, because it had been run by him mostly out at Poly for beginning 5 or 6 years, I guess. It might have been more than 5 or 6 years, but it was at least 5 or 6 years. And so we took it over. Jason absorbed it into his bailiwick, and that's been another arm of the international experience students can have now for several years. So they can either learn about other countries and other issues by going out to them in volunteer work. They can go in travel scholarships that are supported to support their own kind of travel, such as the what was it? Well, it's got this funny name now, but it was an extension of the Explorers. The famous explorers group in New York City. What was
Oh,
it?
Circumnavigators, wasn't
Yes, the
it called that?
yes, exactly. That's what it was. So he started, Circumnavigators started with a Circumnavigators club that was a sub club of the one in New York City in Phoenix, the one that had had some bad experiences with giving money to support a circumnavigation of the globe to just any old ASU student that had a couple of bad experiences. So they approached us and asked us if they could make it only for Barrett students. And we said, "Sure, you can. That'd be wonderful." And then we came up with the money to fund a second student each year besides the one that the Circumnavigators were funding. And as the Circumnavigator Club in Phoenix died off almost literally, I hate to say it, it's sort of lugubrious to say, but the members were very old, wonderful, older guys who slowly passed away. And so we sort of took it over, and that, I forget what Jason calls it now, but it has some lettered moniker now, but it
I'll
stands
see if
for.
it can come to me, but yeah, it's not coming to the tip of my brain. It's funny, I remember the older thing more easily.
But anyway, that was also we Jason has been great in leading the way towards other programs that we develop with him as we talk to him about what he thinks too. He's been a great addition to Barrett. So,
So you mentioned a couple things I'd like to follow up on or expand on. Since we're on the thread of global related things, perhaps you could say more about what study abroad programs were like when you came and how those shifted or expanded while you were here for 19 years. And we have a sense of it, as you've mentioned, the global resolve, and also we brought more international speakers in. But maybe there's something else you'd like to add in that regard.
Well, what existed when I came was were the special trips that the faculty had already devised in most cases. Well, in several of the cases, in every case where it was one of the summer study abroad trips, they had devised it, of course, each faculty member, and they were very successful and very, very well thought of and well subscribed by the students. So that existed, and we continued to fund that. We wanted to purposely fund that and expand it as we expanded the faculty. So those were trips, as you know. I mean, have they been talked about by others in this history of Barrett sort of exercise that we're doing now, or should I talk about those? Should you talk? You could talk about those. I mean, it'd be better to interview a faculty member about those, really.
Yeah, I want you to share whatever you'd like to share. There has been a lot that has happened. I don't know if you're aware that we have a semester abroad now. For instance, Jackie is in Milan and Joe O'Neill is in Rome, and the students are spending half their time. There's two groups of students spending half their time with each faculty member, and then halfway through the semester, they go to the other city to be with the other faculty member.
That's fantastic. That's wonderful. It really warms my heart to hear this stuff because one of the things that really affected me in my whole life was the fact that my father, who was a professor at Princeton, where he had sabbaticals given to him every 5th year. It was very rare because the name sabbatical, of course, implies every 7th year anyway, if you're lucky. And lots of the state universities don't even give sabbaticals, or you have to apply for them, and you get one every 20 years, maybe on average. So, but my father had these sabbaticals given to him, which was half year at full pay or a full year at half pay, with him having to get the rest of the pay. It's sort of fairly standard procedure once the institution has admitted that they would like to give their faculty a sabbatical of any sort. That's usually the way it works. My father had these every 5 years, so I had gone to three or four different nations, but by the time I got to college, starting when I was three or four. We'd gone on one of my father's sabbaticals, and he very strongly believed that it was good for the whole family, particularly my sister and me, to be taken to another country. Not just a lot of faculty with sabbaticals just decide to take them at their home institution and just do some quiet scholarly work. So sometimes not even leaving their office where they've been anyway. My father believed very strongly that we should go to other countries, learn other cultures, and he could immerse himself with the science of the people he was visiting, but we could immerse ourselves in the culture of the country. So I had been to Switzerland, Oxford, England, Naples, Italy, and Berkeley, California, before I even entered college. Each of those was for a year, or maybe in some cases, half a year plus the summer, so it would be 8 months. And I knew that it had really, really affected me. It affected me in totally positive ways. My sister feels the same way when I interview her, talk to her, even now. We both feel the same way. So I'm a big, huge believer. I wanted to make sure that Barrett students didn't just hang out in Arizona. When we first started the Great American Cities program, which was instigated at first by
Abby Longden?
yes. Addie,
Addie.
Addie Longden, yes, who worked at Barrett for a while, but she had this brilliant idea that we could go to to American cities for 3 or 4 day visits, stay in youth hostels, so it was cheap. It was never more than about $500 or $600 for each student anyway. We had scholarships for those. But when those were invented and expanded, it was really, really very popular. But one of the things that stuck with me was I talked to one of the students on one of the first trips that went to New York City after we started this program, and she came back. And I said, "Well, how was it? How did you like it?" And she said, "Oh, it was life-changing." And I said, "Really? How, in what ways?" And she said, "Well, I had never even this is a student who was sort of 18 or 19 years old, remember?" She said, "I'd never left Arizona," she said. And I'd never been on an airplane. I'd never been on a boat." And she meant by a boat, they took a boat to see the Statue of Liberty from the tip of Manhattan. But and she said, and then she said, and then of course there was New York City for crying out loud. And I realized then that actually Barrett students, sometimes there's a subcategory of Barrett student who's brilliant, did well in high school, but is not really privileged enough to have had family to take them everywhere the way I had been taken by my family, of course. And I wanted very much to have one of the major themes that we developed at Barrett be exposure to foreign, to different places, even different places in the U.S., of course, and that's why we expanded the Great American Cities program, but also to other countries, to try to and bring leaders and idea people from other countries in to meet us and our students. So that's sort of the theoretical background, philosophical background for why we expanded all those sorts of programs and why I'm so happy that they've kept expanding. I'm very happy to hear that you've now got some programs that are semester-long programs. That's wonderful to hear.
Yes, and I'm glad that you brought up the Great American Cities because we can experience many different cultures and ways of life just within our giant country. And I don't know if this happened while you were still in Barrett, but we also have faculty doing work and taking students on like borderland excursions for even just a long weekend to help raise their awareness around certain kinds of issues, even closer to home than the Great American Cities did.
Yes, that did start when I was there. It started because we wanted to support that as well. I mean, that was this conscious move to do that. So I'm very happy to say to hear that those are still going on also, of course.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to follow up on was something you had said about how the Rhodes Lecture changed over time at
Yes.
ASU. And just for the record, if anybody doesn't know, it's called the John J. Rhodes Chair in Public Policy and American Institutions Lecture. And not just about that lecture, but I'd like your thoughts, your memories, your insights about what you thought about the Centennial and Rhodes Lecture Series when you got here, and what they maybe meant to you, how they shifted, etc.
Well, I had run a big lecture series at Swarthmore College when I was the associate provost of the college. So I was already a believer in bringing really interesting people in. We had Bill McKibben. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's a great environmental activist from New York. He hangs out really in the Adirondack Mountains in New York State. But I had already brought him in to great applause, I guess you'd say, at Swarthmore. So I already liked the idea of speaker series. And when I got here, I found out, lo and behold, we had these two wonderfully endowed, already present speaker series that had been given to Barrett. The Centennial was actually money that was raised in honor of ASU's Centennial, which was, well, let's see.
1985 would have been 100 years.
Okay, so yeah, I was hesitating because I wasn't sure whether ASU was older than the state, but it is, I think. So the state's centennial was something like.
I think the state was in 1912 or 14, but
Yeah,
ASU
yes.
was founded in 1885
Yeah,
as
yeah.
a
So,
territorial normal school.
Yeah, so that's what they were celebrating. And at the time they were celebrating the centennial of ASU, somebody started raising money. And actually, no, it wasn't that. It's called the Flynn Foundation Centennial Lecture because the Flynn Foundation gave this money, the kernel of it, the core of it, of about $200,000 or $250,000 to ASU in honor of its centennial. That's how it was. So that existed, and that was they when the Flynn Foundation gave that money, they only stipulated that someone who's an interesting speaker slash leader at the national level be brought in to give a talk to the whole university once a year. And the Rhodes, the John J. Rhodes lectureship or chairship, which, by the way, the use of the word chair indicates what it was once, because it was once a chair who came in and had the chair and had it sometimes for the whole semester, sometimes for at least a couple of weeks, and had a short course lectureship, or sometimes just sort of once a week lecture flying in, but for the whole semester. But as a chair, as you'd expect a chair to be, as a professor, a teacher, and a teacher of a course. So, and that was money that was given to by the Rhodes family in honor of John J. Rhodes, who of course was a famous congressman in the United States Congress, and who was one of the people who led Nixon to resign at a crucial point in his presidency. But anyway, these two things existed. They had both been accruing money, I guess, because people had continued to give at least to the Rhodes lectureship. But maybe the centennial was just a straight gift from the Flynn Foundation, that it was just accruing interest. But they both were $200,000 or $300,000 as their base, so they were spinning off, $10,000, $20,000 just in interest each year. And so we were able to pay speaker fees for people who were pretty well known. Centennial was never more than just a speaker who came in for 2 or 3 days. We would arrange visits to classes, visits. We would arrange visits. We would always advertise them because we felt it was our responsibility, even though both of these had been given before I came in 03 to Barrett to administer. We felt it was important that they both were, when we brought these people in, they had a chance to meet with people across the whole university. So we always advertised who it was. We'd write to Peggy, was very good at usually knowing who might particularly be interested in the speakers we had chosen in other colleges or other departments, and advertising their presence so that they could meet with people's classes in the larger ASU each time, particularly with the centennial, because that centennial was never really it was a lectureship, not a chair, or not meant to be a course that was taught. The Rhodes lecture, though, which also could bring in, you could use its interest each year to bring in really well-known people. Those people, it was stipulated by the gift that they involved great American institutions that were seen as important to the development and the evolution and the history of the country, as John J. Rhodes himself was. So those when I first came, we were picking someone who could come in for a couple of weeks or maybe even a month worth of visits and have a chair dedicated to them, an office, which a centennial lecturer didn't usually have, but an office, because if their presence was going to be as a teacher for several weeks or even a month or so, then they needed to have, and they of course needed an office to interact with students from. So that's what the Rhodes was like at the time. Now the Rhodes changed. The centennial hasn't changed really. It's still the same wonderful opportunity to bring in a really great person. And the greatness could be defined in any way for the centennial, pretty much. But for the Rhodes, it's still we've maintained the connection to great Americans who have particularly been successful at promoting the welfare of the people in journalism or politics or sort of the public sphere. in some way or other. However, the Rhodes family, who was intimately involved with choosing who the Rhodes speaker would be each year, began to ask after maybe 2010 or so, whether we could have people who were better known coming in. Now, the trouble with that is to get someone like Condoleezza Rice. Whoops. Oh, sorry. That was just my computer beeped at me. To get someone like Condoleezza Rice, she charges $200,000 for to speak, usually. And so, if we wanted to have someone, we got her, but she's a different story. We got her as a special visitor with Barbara's help. But that I can go back and talk to you about that. But she never came as a Rhodes lecturer. But to use the Rhodes Endowment to get someone like that, we had to stop having it be a whole month residency. Excuse me, I just have to
Take your time.
have a little sip of water. So the Rhodes, when the Rhodes family wanted to have more prominently, obviously named people come in, because we started finding good people, but who were not so well known, who could come for a month or so, because their schedules allowed it. But the more famous people couldn't come for that amount of time, of course, or they could only if they were paid a huge amount of money. So we changed the roads. The roads sort of changed to be more like the centennial in that sense. And although it's still called the John J. Rhodes Chair. And because even with the centennial model, we made these people available for 3 or 4 days around the campus, and they still give a public lecture, and they could go visit other classes besides just Barrett honors classes. So it's still a very good and useful endowed lectureship, but it changed its nature a little bit. And Ted Humphrey was sort of displeased with that, I think, because he had envisioned it when he first talked to the Rhodeses about it. When they t started talking to him about, I don't know who initiated that interaction, but it was always connected to the Honors College, so Ted was involved. I think Ted really liked the idea of having a famous person come in and be able to interact with students in less formal way over a longer period of time, like a classroom. And I sort of certainly spiritually agreed with that, but I also could see that the Rhodeses were wanting to have people who were more prominent come in. So we changed it to be more like the centennial format of only 2 or 3 day visit.
Well, it'll
That's
be
all.
interesting to see if or how it changes in the future.
Yeah.
Do any particular speakers in either series stand out in your memory besides Condoleezza Rice,
Well,
who wasn't even really a Rhodes one?
Condoleezza Rice was a world leader brought in by the Barrett funded special leaders series. In fact, she was the first or second one of those, I think. And that was an interesting case where it was absolutely typical of how Barbara can help the Honors College. Barbara knows her. She usually charges $200,000. She only would charge. She said she would do it for less. Only 100,000, I think it was, and then she also only always travels first class, and Barbara paid for one of those flights, I believe. So it was engineered by Barbara, and she was one of the best speakers we'd ever had. Students absolutely loved her, and her speech. I was the sort of just the mediator of the speech, so I heard it, and it was a fantastic speech.
That was in
So
2017 that she came, just if that helps us remember.
yeah, I think it was the first year of Trump's first term, because
So that was also the year that another global leader, as you mentioned before, the former defense minister of Finland and undersecretary of the general of the United Nations came in that same year that Condoleezza Rice came in.
right. Those were all global leaders brought in by the Barrett-funded program. So those were absolutely incredible, but
Did
they
any,
weren't Rhodes or Centennial speakers.
yeah, so any Rhodes or Centennial speakers stand out to you? It's
Oh yes,
okay.
very, very much. Well, I mean, first of all, Jules Feiffer is one of my favorite people of all time, See, the thing about Rhodes and Centennial was a small group of people at Barrett, which always included me, got to pick who these people were. And it was wonderful. It was a chance to bring in anyone that one liked, because luckily we all the small group of people who were sort of the chair of the faculty, the troika that was running Barrett, Kristen, Peggy, and me, and just a few other people, were almost always in agreement each year about what we should do. We were very careful to balance it with by gender, by area of topics. Particularly the Centennial, because the Centennial was open to any area, so we were trying very liberally to be balanced in all sorts of ways, and we were successful at that. But within those strictures, we could pick. It was like a carte blanche to bring in anyone you wanted, and we had this huge endowment behind it, basically. So as a payment for just one lecture, it was still a very good deal for the people coming and visiting. So we could attract really good people. We had Jules Feiffer. We had Edward Albee. My mother was really, really jealous of me for that. She was an English teacher in high school, and she always taught Albee plays, and she loved them. I got him to sign a copy of his most recent play for her. But these people were fantastic. I mean, you can look at the list. It's really a wonderful list of some of them activists in certain environmental areas, but others just famous people.
Yes, the
So,
centennial in 2024 was Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter, Bernice King, and that was a very meaningful one for folks to attend to. And it inspired me to add a Martin Luther King Jr. text to my spring human event class, 272.
oh, that's
And,
great.
I wish I'd done it sooner, but I think that kind of interaction between having different kinds of thinkers come in, and when faculty and students go to these, it inspires them to look deeper or broader than they had before.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the whole idea of any speaker series. And in fact, when I first came in 03, the Rhodes and Centennial existed, but there weren't any of these others, not the global leaders or anything else like that. So I started the Honors Lecture Series by myself, because and that was supposed to be just other really interesting people from ASU, or maybe from Phoenix itself, but mostly from ASU, other faculty, just so that our faculty and other faculty at the big ASU could understand what really good work was going on just at ASU by ASU faculty. And when that started, it was three or four sp speakers each semester, because there wasn't any other lecture series at the time, except for Rhodes and Centennial, which were one-offs in the fall and the spring, of course. So I'm sort of proud of starting that, although it's sort of fallen by the wayside, just because we've got so many other gloriously wonderful people coming in anyway now. But the whole idea, again, the spirit behind all of these was for the travel. It was the wonderful education that travel can give you. And it's the same thing goes for just a single set of lectures that you can go to regularly, or choose when to go to, that can stimulate you the way, for instance, Martin Luther King's daughter stimulated you. But I wanted to set up a framework where people would be coming in regularly to give those kinds of talks, just for all of our edification.
Well, good job on that. And perhaps you could expand a little bit more about a difference between the Centennial Lecture Series and the Rhodes Lecture Series, which is the broadsides. What do
Oh,
you
the
remember or know
broadsides.
about the broadsides that happen in connection with the Centennial?
Well, that was. The broadsides were already a tradition of the Rhodes, wasn't it?
No,
What?
it's actually connected to the centennial.
Okay. So that was started by Ted, I assume.
I'm going to ask him specifically about the broadsides next time we speak, but I just wondered if you had any insight on them and the process of them, or how the speaker maybe felt honored, or if they didn't like sitting there and signing them, because sometimes a number of them are signed.
Oh yeah, there's about 50 that are usually made, and something like 50 signed by the speaker. that was the tradition that was there. I have copies of almost every one of those that would happen during my 19 years, and they're wonderful. I mean, the artist who made them was a terrific artist, first of all. So they had lots of worth just because of their beauty. Then there was usually a quote that was picked out from the person's work, and I don't know whether the artist picked that out or whether it was picked out by the speaker. I don't remember how that happened because it was sort of separately negotiated, and they were sort of secretly signing the 50 broadsides before they left. But I never was in on the signing too much, except for when I had to sign them myself, of course, at the end. But it was so the quote, the beauty of the piece itself, and then the fact that it commemorated a famous person coming to give a talk. So that was, for instance, Jules Feiffer's one that I have a copy of, has his signature. Some of these things are probably worth quite a lot of money now, although that's not the purpose of them. I would never sell them. But we put them up in the hallway to sort of show students who, what sort of people have been coming in for the centennial. So I think that the tradition was a terrific one. I cannot claim credit for that starting. I think it must have been Ted or someone else who started the tradition of having a broadside at all. But the broadsides were really valuable on multiple levels, I feel.
They were and are and could be, again, in the sense that at the time of the event, for anyone listening to this who hasn't been to a centennial lecture, there's often a reception beforehand. And one of the broadsides, which is kind of a hand printed or printed in an old style, not mass produced, but on very thick, ragged edge paper that somebody has hand lovingly printed a limited series of, is framed in some really lovely way, and then it's unveiled at the centennial lecture before the lecture begins. So there's
That's
a
great.
nice little bit of ritual or ceremony in that moment, at least.
Absolutely, I totally agree. It's a wonderful, wonderful tradition.
And I would like to talk more to you and Ted about some of the ways those broadsides may have been used in relationship building or could be used in the future, because now we have over 30 years worth of broadsides and I have been through them and I'm still working my way through them. And there was a time in our history where we made as many as 150 of them and other
Really?
times where we made as few as only 10.
Really? I
And
didn't know.
that's interesting to think about how those can be used as gifts or for relationship building or education, etc. There's a richness there that I think over Barrett's history has gone up and down over the years, and we're in a spell right now where we're maybe not utilizing or leveraging everything around the Centennial series and these broadsides as much as we possibly could.
That's probably in part due to the lack of continuity we've had in our director of development. You know, because that's the person who is usually, when you say that they were used sometimes in the past as gifts, they certainly were. And that was usually it was initiated by the person who was a director of development to give to one of the donors in honor of their birthday or some aspect of their life. With going through the broadsides to pick someone or a quote or a person who they knew that donor probably liked particularly. And that has been done in the past, I know, but it's a great wealth of, it's sort of a treasure trove of items that could be used that way. But I think the interruptions we've had in the director of development position have prevented someone from getting that into being a tradition itself.
Thank you for mentioning that, Mark. I had spoken to a director of development about this before, and you're right. I mean, she was excited. She didn't know we really had some that we could share. And before she and I got to dig into it more, she was headhunted away to the Mayo Clinic. So
Yes, yes.
now yet a new person is coming in, and I haven't had a chance to meet that person yet.
Well, if you're the connection between that kind of person and you're the one who's, I mean, I didn't know anyone had gone through all of them the way you have. That's really great that you do know, you're probably the very valuable person in terms of the knowledge of those broadsides to all of Barrett, and you should be the one who talks to the next director of development to tell them about them.
Thank you. I will do that. I just want to note that I can't believe how time has flown by. We're approaching an hour in this conversation, and there's so many things I didn't get to ask you about. We can talk for a bit longer in this conversation, especially it might be useful if there's anything else we can think about on the themes that we've already been talking about global education and lecture series and community outreach and relationship building. But I hope that you'll be willing to please schedule another conversation because I've got quite a list of achievements that you've done and things I'd like to help the current and future generations appreciate more about your time at Barrett.
Of course, I'd be happy to talk any amount of future times.
Thank you for that willingness.
Sure, of course.
So in terms of the Honors Lecture Series, the Rhodes, the Centennial, anything else about those topics or global resolve, global education in general that comes to mind?
I've sort of explained the philosophy behind wanting to have those programs already. And
Yes.
I think we have covered a lot of them, actually.
Good. So
There's not another major one out there that I don't think we've covered.
I think what may be useful for us to do then is to punctuate this conversation so that we've got a nice nugget on these topics. And I'll save some of my questions for another time, except that, since we did start talking a little bit about development and fundraising and relationship building and perhaps using the broadsides to that end again in the future. I wonder if you could talk about Campaign 2020. And I know 2020 was when the COVID-19 pandemic hit. I also know that that's, a few years later you retired, but for a few years before Campaign 2020 ended with in that COVID year, I remember you being active and creative in the Campaign 2020 effort. So maybe you could say a little bit more about that. And you had some particular goals for it. And I can remind you of what those are, but I would love to hear them in your voice, and whatever you want to share about it.
Well, maybe you could tell me what you think they were,
Well,
just to get me started.
based on the 30th anniversary oral history that was done, oh, 6, 7 years ago now, you talked about the four goals: to further support faculty through funding, student scholarship support, building and staffing a student success center, and creating the Global Initiatives Program to increase the exposure of Barrett students to global issues, which we've kind of talked about in other ways, but not using that exact term. So,
Yes.
thoughts on those four things in particular? And I'm sure you were doing much more, but those are the ones that I know about.
Well, the one that was sort of taking up a lot of our time at that time was the Student Success Center, which we almost had built. We had architectural drawings for it and thought we had money for it, but that was the one that was connected to some extent to Tom Lewis and
Okay.
his funds. So, and that's another story, as you know. So that ended up not going anywhere in the end.
Well, we do have a student success center now, so I'm sure that those efforts mattered because we have a space over in Vista del Sol that we call the Student Success Center, and things are going on there all the time.
That's good to know. I didn't know that was still true, because when I left, We had just opened that with, I mean, it was called the Lewis Student Success Center, but then Tom became disaffected, I guess, with the way things were going and stopped supporting Barrett with his funds. So I didn't know what had happened to that. So that's good to hear that it's still going. Because I mean, the idea of it, the principle behind it is absolutely terrific.
It
But
is, yeah. Lots of personal development classes are happening, and that space is used for a variety of things in addition to individual personal development kinds of things.
so who's overseeing the center, do you know?
Not off the top of my head, I don't think it has the same kind of format that it did when you and Tom envisioned it, but the seeds that you two and others worked on together definitely took enough root that regardless of the vagaries of what happens with development kinds of monies, this center and a number of for credit classes are still happening and non-credit kinds of things as well.
Yeah, well, those classes were terrific ideas, and I'm glad to hear that they were retained. And I assume the faculty teaching them were retained too, because there were two or three faculty that were supported by the Lewis funds, which were a mixture of our funds and Lewis's funds.
They have been retained, yes.
Yeah, and you told me the last time we had an interview that three of the faculty were still on Barrett's books, right?
Yeah, and I think those were the unique three, and any other classes were kind of a taught sometimes by the faculty that were here before the center was founded. So
Right.
there was some faculty involved, and then we hired those new people, and they have been retained.
Well, the thing that I would say is most important about this whole story is that the concept that students need to be shepherded more and shown how to be successful later in life with skills they learn in college is the core of what Tom believed, and I totally support it. I still would totally support. In other words, I think the thing that he hit on was that as he said, students can go through 4 years of college if they've planned out, particularly if they're, say, an engineering student or a biology student and they're wanting to be a nurse or a PhD in biology or an engineer. They can be very nose to the grindstone and be very successful. If they're smart Barrett students, they're going to be successful, getting A's and everything, looking like total success. But they're not being they're missing out on some of the other sorts of things that might make them successful people. And that's what we were trying to focus on with the courses that were offered. And he had this, it was a lot of these ideas came from Tom himself. And that's the part about Tom that I hope is not discredited by the fact that he withdrew his funds and sort of disappeared from the picture a little bit, because they're very good ideas. And we
Yeah, they
wanted to,
are.
yeah.
And you know,
And
since we're on the top, oh, go ahead and finish your thought.
that's okay. That's okay. I was pretty much finished.
This is just reminding me that you were approached so many times over the years by different people, nationally and internationally, who had started to take notice of Barrett and how they could achieve something similar. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about, how you helped directly or indirectly get an honors college started or named by Tom Lewis in Kentucky, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was. But it was, I mean, the Barrett diaspora is what I call it. The Barrett diaspora is a huge, I think it's had a huge effect on education in American public universities, really. I mean, there are lots of honors colleges that started and were designed directly after Barrett, designed or headed in there with their first dean by a person who was a dean at Barrett or a faculty member who had been at Barrett in some administrative role. And then there were exact copies of Barrett, which is what the University of Kentucky one is very much like. So I could go on for hours about those sorts of things. But Purdue started an honors college because they thought that Barrett was a great model. Portland State, which was headed by the vice president for development, I guess, there Excuse me, for research and development. Let me just take a little more water. I think I said I'm using my voice so much more than I usually do each day. I'm talking like this.
Well, we can
It's
wrap up soon, and I
no,
appreciate your efforts.
that's okay. That's okay. It's okay. Let me just finish this thought that Purdue was designed after a visiting committee that included me that went to it and told them what they needed to do if they wanted to have a really good honors college. Portland State was the same way. They didn't have any honors college and they were trying to start one. And that was Jonathan. He'd been a vice president for research here, but what was his last name? I don't remember his last name, but
Was it Fink?
yes, Jonathan Fink, exactly. He knew what Barrett was like. And so he wanted to start a Barrett there, and he brought us up there for as consultants for that reason. I mean, the influence that we've had, we being Peggy and Kristen and me, but a lot of times for these sorts of visits, I was on the visiting committee at Colorado State. The influence we've had has been huge, and the diaspora is served not only by the ideas of how you design an honors college as they move out into the country, like the Kentucky story, but also the people who come from Barrett and then go to these places, including most recently, of course, the dean of the Pittsburgh University of Pittsburgh Honors College, who is for the former vice dean here.
Oh, that's right, Nicola Foot.
Yes, Nicola. So even if something exists, the person goes there, suddenly there's a donor who wants to name the Honors College there, and a lot of the ideas that were successful here are implemented at these other places. So it's and this includes international places too. I mean, we've had an influence on the Honors program, or the equivalent of the residential college program at some of the European universities. And some of the Chinese universities from after committees came to visit us here and wanted to implement some of the things we were doing here at their institutions, sometimes inviting us to go, but sometimes just taking the ideas and implementing them themselves. So there's the whole idea. I mean, the thing I'm most proud of, actually, of all, is that what this has done is it's brought a much higher quality of education to public university good scholars who otherwise would have never had the chance to take part in programs like some of these. And I think that's been a huge influence on, I mean, if I want to sound the most pompous that I can, a huge influence on American education, American college education.
Well, it doesn't sound pompous to me. It sounds accurate and descriptive. Both you and Ted Humphrey and Peggy and Kristen and the different people that have been involved in this endeavor from the beginning all have made ripple effects into the present and the future because if Ted hadn't put this Honors College, managed to pull it together at ASU and just the whole founding of it, how it developed, et cetera, has definitely changed the face of Arizona State University as well as all these other places that you've mentioned.
Oh yeah, and even when someone like Mary Ingram Waters goes to Nevada, she's having the same that even though the Honors College may have existed before, when they get someone who knows from the inside how it runs, that's another example of the seeping out of good ideas and good programs from Barrett to other places. It's really very important in the development of honors work across the whole country, I think.
It is. And, maybe the amount of attention or the brightness of what Barrett offers will be seen differently because when you have a first super bright candle, it shows up in the room a lot more than when you have 100 candles in that dark room.
Yeah.
And so the ripple effect is happening more and more, even if there's fewer people perhaps coming to Barrett to ask for advice directly. It's because there's a number of other good colleges, honors colleges now, as a result of of the 2 degrees of separation, the 3 degrees of separation, the basically grandchildren of this, the children and grandchildren of Barrett and other of the very early honors colleges.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. The F2s, as we say in biology, so the second generations. Yeah, and I think a good time to promote this would certainly be the upcoming national the hero meeting that's about to happen at Barrett Tempe. You know about that, right?
I do. I've proposed a panel for it, but what are your
Oh, great.
thoughts on it?
Well, I mean, it's a good chance if you have a panel already proposed, maybe. Whether there's one proposal, whether there's a special program, there should be something that's done, I think, that shows sort of a basically a chart in one way or another of the diaspora of ideas and honors colleges from Barrett, because that would be a chance to get that seen by people who are interested in honors from all over the country anyway.
Oh,
And
that's
probably.
such a good idea. Unfortunately, I don't, that's not related to what I proposed to panel on. And I don't know if it's too late to propose panels now, but like you said, maybe something could be prepared by a staff member who talks to you. Maybe you could start generating a list of everything that you remember. Maybe there's time to put something together to help show that diaspora. I wish we'd had the thought sooner to make sure it could happen, but maybe it still can.
Yeah, well, isn't the meeting's scheduled for the fall, isn't it?
It's in May.
Oh, it's in May. Okay, so it's coming up very soon. Yeah. Okay, well, I can talk to Tara about it
Okay.
a little
Well,
bit.
for now, why don't we wrap up this conversation? And as I said earlier, I'm so grateful that we got your insights on global education and the lecture series and some insights on student success and the diaspora of Barrett. And I look forward to when we talk next.
That'd be great. I look forward to it also as well.
Thank you, Mark. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.